Should we have any hope in the Democrats when it comes to fighting Trump and the oligarchy? In February, a long-term Democratic strategist laid out his answer pretty clearly when he said, quote, "With no clear leader to voice our opposition and no control in any branch of government, it's time for Democrats to embark on the most daring political maneuver in the history of our party. Rollover." Basically, according to the strategist, the go would be that they do not lift a finger to obstruct Trump's agenda, they just wait for his train to roll out of steam and then try and pick up some support in the midterms. Not very promising. What about fighting the oligarchy? Probably most of you here at the Socialism Conference could just take one look at the Democrat, top Democrat net worths to understand why they're not going to be doing that anytime soon. The upper echelons of the party regularly are 100 millionaires, and senators overall for the party are kind of scrimping by with a median of $3 million apiece net worth. So because of this, the kind of facts that I think that really tells you, in my talk, I'm not going to spend heaps and heaps of time talking about them. Instead, I want to be looking at the left flank of the Democratic Party, which can seem a lot more compelling to left-wing people. It's figures like Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Zohran Mamdani, backed up by organisations like the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, as well as publications like Jacobin magazine. They can seem to offer a bit more hope when it comes to challenging Trump and capitalism's horrors. So in the context of Democratic despair and capitulation to Trump, which I mentioned earlier, Bernie Sanders and AOC bucked the trend by launching a Fighting the Oligarchy tour of the country, drawing crowds of tens of thousands, connecting people who wanted to fight Trump's reactionary social agenda and link it to his war on workers. Zohran Mamdani similarly captured a lot of hope on the left with his calls for a rent freeze, affordable housing, free buses and childcare, and his combative approach to his establishment Democrat opponent. He was attacked, like slandered, for his support for Palestine, and he faced down rivers of Wall Street money backing the other side, and yet he won the Democratic primary party race for New York mayor anyway, with an army of tens of thousands of young volunteers. And I think there are serious positives to draw out of these two campaigns. The fact that they prove there exists a huge audience in American society who want a left alternative to both Trumpism and mainstream Democrats. People who, millions, you know, who back calls, what are they back calls for? We will never know. We'll never, ever, ever know. People who back calls for fighting inequality and taxing the rich. They back those calls even when, or especially when, they're connected to taking left-wing stances on social issues like Palestine or LGBT rights. Plus, it's always great when you get to see the, you know, super rich of New York really panic at the prospect of higher taxes. All of these lessons, I think, can help to bolster the confidence of left-wing people, and they're important developments for us to register. But while we recognise the positive lessons where they exist, I think it's just as important for us to be able to really soberly and critically analyse the prospects and limitations of various strategies for actually fighting the hellscape that is American capitalism in 2025. So that is what my talk is mainly going to focus on. I want to explain why I think the Democratic Party is a dead end for socialists, whether that's the party mainstream or its left flank also. And I'm going to argue instead that socialists need to build a new party that can fight for the interests of the working class with independent forces and an orientation to the streets and not the White House. So let's begin, first of all, with a recent look at the record of the left inside the Democrats, because I think it really serves as a bit of a warning of what we should expect from these developments. So I'll first start with Bernie Sanders. Sanders' rise to prominence came when he led an insurgent campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016, backed by the DSA. His campaign was full of scathing attacks on the rich, but also on the Democratic establishment, which saw his popularity grow to tens of thousands of supporters. And when it looked like he maybe actually had a shot at becoming the nominee, the Democratic Party establishment quickly moved in with a coordinated campaign to stop that, and then again mobilised to defeat him in the early primaries of 2020 by getting every other candidate to just drop out of the race and throw their lot in behind Joe Biden. And I think the speed at which the establishment carried out these manoeuvres against Sanders, someone whose platform consisted of fairly moderate social democratic measures that were actually perfectly compatible with capitalism, but I think the speed with which they crushed that, I think, is one of the best indications of how tightly dominated and impermeable the party structures are. Signs of why it's really impossible to fight for a left-wing agenda within the Democratic Party. But Sanders himself was never going to countenance a break with the party. He saw himself as a loyal opposition within it, rather than someone seriously trying to hurt it in any way. And he actually attacked his supporters who argued that he should have kept on running as an independent because he said this would simply risk getting the Republicans elected. And he wound up towing the line, you know, campaigning full-throatedly for Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden in 2016 and 2020. In this view, the Democrats, no matter how evil, they're always a lesser evil to be defended against criticism. And that is an idea with a long history, which I'll come back to later. Again and again, I think the trajectory of socialists inside the Democratic Party follows this dynamic of moving upwards and rightwards, as the historian Kim Moody described it. And I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or AOC, I think her rise to power is a really good illustration of this. So her successful bid in 2018 to unseat Joe Crowley, a long-term Democratic power broker from New York, was a kind of other big major challenge to the Democratic establishment in recent years. Just grab this. I think part of AOC's popularity, alongside her, there were kind of three other progressive congresspeople who together became known as the Squad. And they were hailed by the DSA as a real vindication of the strategy that socialists should work within the Democratic Party. Part of her popularity really came from painting herself as someone who did politics differently. And in one of her first acts as Congresswoman, she joined in on an occupation of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office alongside climate activists trying to protest Pelosi's ties to the fossil fuel industry. But even in this disruptive gesture, AOC was very sure to explain that it was not meant to be seen as a direct challenge to Pelosi and, by extension, the party establishment. Instead, it was an attempt to gently nudge Pelosi, someone who, quote, appreciates civic engagement, in the right direction. And within a few months, AOC and the Squad ended up backing Pelosi, a right-wing establishment Democrat and venture capitalist whose net worth is, yeah, upwards of $100 million. They backed her re-election as party leader in 2018, and AOC very soon christened her as the mama bear of the Democratic Party. So I think the well-worn trajectory of attempted reformers to the party moving upwards and rightwards goes like this. Left-wing candidates win their position on a progressive platform. Once in Congress, they throw out their anti-establishment rhetoric for loyalty to the party establishment, usually in order to be allowed to sit on influential congressional committees, for instance. But getting into places of influence always means paying the price. So for AOC, this meant being prepared to withhold endorsements for other progressive candidates if the party apparatus deemed that needed to happen. So sometimes this even meant giving money from her fundraising committee to back establishment centrists in the party, like when the Squad unanimously backed Hakeem Jeffries as Pelosi's successor, even though he's kind of famously very hostile to the left. For Sanders, it meant full-throatedly, yeah, backing Clinton and Biden, and AOC and Sanders, who both were kind of celebrated by the DSA for their attempt to push the Democratic Party towards the left by entering it, actually just end up tying their campaign and their supporters to the right. And they're kind of kept around as useful tools for the establishment to help cover, help give left cover to pro-capitalist politicians. So 2016, Sanders goes from relentless critic of Clinton to championing her policy platform of neoliberal cuts and warmongering foreign policy as, quote, the most progressive in history. And later, both he and AOC went on to become some of the most consistent defenders of the Biden administration, all the way until he drops out of the race in 2024, seriously. Even when establishment figures, news outlets, George Clooney, you know, they're all clogged that Biden's embarrassing debate performance means that he's probably got to go. Sanders and AOC are the people loyally standing up for Uncle Joe, you know, one of the key architects for the genocide in Gaza, describing him as the most effective president in the modern history of our country. So I think, you know, the trajectory of AOC and Sanders in the Democratic Party not only turned them from kind of opponents of the establishment into rehabilitators of it, but also, as they climbed further and further up the ranks, the loyalty that they had to the Democratic Party became loyalty actually to the party's approach to running US capitalism in all of its horrors. So AOC, who once kind of posed for a photo crying in front of an ICE detention center, condemning Trump putting kids in cages, in concentration camps, as she called them, went very silent when the Democrats actually continued much of Trump's cruel immigration policy under Biden, down to reopening some of the very same cage-like facilities, which were now rebranded by her into overflow facilities for unaccompanied migrant children. Quite the tune change. And in 2022, AOC, as well as a couple of other DSA members of Congress, voted to ban a strike of railroad workers and unilaterally impose a contract on them, which they'd already rejected. Most notoriously, she repeatedly refused to vote against giving billions and billions of dollars to supporting the Israeli war machine. Similarly, in terms of, you know, how where this politics can end you up, Sanders wound up just recently actually opposing the LA protests against ICE, claiming that they had been violent and disruptive. He even actually praised Trump's border crackdown in March of this year, arguing that one failing of the Biden administration had been not being tough enough on the border.
Shame.
So that's my potted history of where this path has gotten us before. I think in order to understand kind of why these attempts to capture the Democratic Party, to try to build a political alternative with an agenda that actually conflicts against the Democratic machine, to try and understand why they bump into a big problem, we should go in a little bit closer into trying to understand what this party actually is. So as the world's oldest capitalist party, the Democratic Party has a deeply undemocratic machine run by millionaires and billionaires. The vast bulk of the party's funding comes from particular capitalists, especially finance and Wall Street. And day to day, the party gets run by a bunch of professional politicians and bureaucrats that are kind of drawn from the upper echelons of society, all of whom are ideologically committed to capitalism. It has next to no formal democratic structures, to the point where you cannot even join the Democratic Party as a member who gets to like have a vote on things like party candidates and stuff like that. Instead, the selection of party candidates is done through the undemocratic labyrinth processes of the primary system, which sees candidates kind of compete against each other in ballots that are open to the public. And this mechanism, it was actually designed to weed out progressives. And a study, does it very effectively. A study found out in 2020 that 79% of the time, the candidates who win contested positions in the party are the ones who spend the most money. Usually, most of this comes from kind of big money fundraising committees called political action committees or PACs. Other safeguards against anti-establishment candidates include things like the superdelegate votes that carry for presidential races, where basically a portion of votes are just allocated to the party elite and other wealthy donors, and they often end up deciding who actually wins the nomination, a process which ordinary kind of party supporters have absolutely no say over. A party that is structured like this cannot be captured. Its kind of ballot line can't be used to push for a progressive agenda, and the whole sordid history of attempts to carry this project out, I think, are the living proof of that. Now, to say that both the Democrats and the Republicans are capitalist parties, that doesn't mean that they're both exactly the same beast. The rise of the Trumpian kind of far right, I think, attests to that in some ways. But it is to say that both parties accept a pro-capitalist framework for their politics, and there is actually way more that unites them in the world of capitalist politics than there is that divides them. When it comes to differentiation, the biggest point of this is really just the progressive gloss which the Democrats kind of want to paint their running of the capitalist system with. They can show a bit more support for moderate liberal measures in a way that the Republicans cannot. And I think having this shallow differentiation is useful for the capitalist class, actually. It's useful for them to have a party that's kind of seen as a lesser evil to the Republicans while still being fundamentally loyal to their class interests. It means, you know, they can be slotted in if at any time opposition to Republican agendas become too widespread. And having this system prevents a third-party challenge from ever emerging, which the capitalists don't have control over. Secondly, it allows the Democrats actually to play a really key role in relating to social movements in a way that the Republicans can't, which is why the party has earned the moniker on the left of the graveyard of social movements. This refers to its history as kind of posing of the party of the people to successfully demobilise, co-opt and contain various radical movements through history, from the combative labour movement of the 30s to the civil rights movement of the 60s. Again and again in American history, you see protest movements get moderated and wound into electoral campaigns for the party, and activists get drawn into the structures of the party only to be pacified. In part, this is why the party can actually just allow a little bit of space for the Bernie Sanders or the AOCs of the world to have a little bit of say in the party. It's why it can allow an organisation like the DSA to operate within it. The Democratic Party can tolerate such efforts so long as, you know, it helps them kind of keep presenting as a big tent organisation, helps them enlist new voters in Democrat caucuses, helps them expand the Democratic Party base, all while knowing that they still hold the leash through their very fine-tuned mechanisms to destroy, you know, disrupt and co-opt any potential challenges that could arise. So for all of these structural reasons, I think socialists should have absolutely no truck with the Democratic Party. So in the talk so far, I've kind of explained why the structures of the Democratic Party are quite a major barrier to any progressive change, and also why the history of the Sanders and AOC phenomena kind of are arguments against why socialists should ever look to this party or should try to changing it from within. And I think, really, when you look at Zoran Mamdani, you know, just weeks after the shock upset of this kind of new kid on the block of the Democratic Party scene, already you can actually start to see this trajectory of moderation emerging. So with the mayoral election just around the corner in November, he's already actually begun a process of trying to shore up a bit of support from New York City's business elite. So in various closed-door meetings with top business executives, he's already started to walk back some of his statements, like saying, like walking back the statement that billionaires shouldn't exist, wavering on his plans to implement a rent freeze and repudiating the pro-Palestine slogan "Globalize the Intifada" in a kind of, you know, sop to the right-wing Zionist establishment of New York. Importantly, he has also already walked back a bunch of his past criticisms of the New York police during his campaign, and he said he's open to keeping Jessica Tisch, the billionaire police commissioner, in her role. So despite being this candidate who harnessed the hopes of anti-racist and Palestine solidarity activists, Mamdani has actually pledged to maintain the current level of New York police funding, which is the same police department that was used to brutally crack down on the Gaza Solidarity encampment at Columbia University last year. And all of these compromises that I've gone through so far, these have all been made before Mamdani has even gotten into power. This is just what it takes to try to climb up the Democratic Party totem pole, to try to win over a section of the real power brokers in the capitalist society to your side. And I think the difficulties and pressures that Mamdani would come under if he actually becomes mayor would be even bigger because of what that role just actually entails. Being New York City mayor would make you one of the largest employers in the city. It would immediately put you actually in opposition to the union claims of hundreds of thousands of workers in the city. You would have to run the city's police force. You have to try to attract investment into the city. You got to try to keep the level of capital accumulation high for the bosses. And I think absolutely none of that should be something that socialists are really fighting to do. There's actually, I think, a bit of a precedent in this in the US well before Mamdani, which is the mayor of Chicago, Brandon Johnson. People might have heard of this guy. He was also a DSA-backed progressive candidate who won that role in 2023. He had a background in the Chicago Teachers Union. He ran a progressive campaign. But after winning the election, he actually induced unions in Chicago to sign onto a no-strike pledge so that the Democrats wouldn't be embarrassed during their national convention held in Chicago last year. And he sent in the police to harass and arrest pro-Palestine protesters outside the convention, including many of the activists who would have got him elected in the first place. So I think the pressure on Mamdani from the capitalists and state bureaucrats to act in that exact same way would be even more intense coming from New York, given it's the nerve center of global finance and the ultra wealthy. As well as that, he has to contend with a potentially hostile Trump administration as well. And I think Mamdani's political strategy is totally ill-equipped to withstand any of these pressures. His program kind of in no way really expresses a real desire to confront the right-wing forces within the establishment of his party, the state, or the capitalist class. Because even his main proposals, you know, while they're very much supportable, they're far from radical. So demands for rent control and free bus routes, they can just as easily fit into the programs of liberal candidates. And even the previous billionaire mayor of New York, Bloomberg, supported a free intercity bus program just a few years ago. Outside of minor tax reform, none of Mamdani's proposals actually involve taking significant wealth and power away from New York's richest. And that partly, I think, is by design. In all of this, there is just no sense here of a fight for progressive change being something that is linked to the struggles of workers coming into conflict with capitalist institutions. There is no bit of this strategy that looks to harnessing the power of workers, students, activists in the workplaces, in the streets, in the fight for reforms for themselves. And I think that is absolutely a needed approach for any left-wing person in America serious about confronting the behemoth forces of Trump, the oligarchy, and the capitalist system that is turning people's lives to shit across the country. And I think when it comes to that sort of fighting, combative approach, we got to say, there would be a huge reception for that right now in America. We've seen massive protests against Trump, some of the biggest ever in American history, break out all across the country. Hatred of, you know, Elon Musk that got expressed in a small way in those Tesla takedown protests targeting his car dealerships and things like that. The protests in LA, all of this, I think, is an indication of just how much anger, how much potential desire to act there is in the population. But none of these strategies actually try to mobilize any of that. Instead, the framework put forward by Mamdani, AOC, Sanders, the Democratic Socialists of America, their entire framework is about having left-wing individuals enter into important positions and then trying to work inside the Democrats. That is their strategy, despite the fact it's been tried and tried again to the same sordid results. I think socialists need to break with a strategy that relegates them to being the foot soldiers and cheerleaders for Democratic Party elected officials. This is a strategy that, you know, really is just headed towards defeat when it comes to advancing our side's aims. I think the biggest problem with it, though, is not even just that it's a strategy that will lead to defeat. I think the biggest problems, you know, what we've seen with the process, the rapid process of taming and co-option that has occurred in previous instances of applying this strategy, I think the real problem here is the resulting demoralization and disorientation it leads to for much of the support base of these figures, the kind of thing that has really disastrous political consequences. The fact that, you know, the Sanders campaign in 2016, AOC's campaign, all of these things saw thousands of young left-wing people become members of the Democratic Socialists of America, be drawn into political activity, into canvassing for these candidates, people who were enthused by the approach of combativity, the approach of having progressive demands, and all of that, who have now ended, a few years later, either demoralized, sucked into the Democratic establishment, or otherwise, you know, kind of left to their own devices instead of being put into a combative fight that could actually win things. So I just want to conclude now by emphasizing that I think really getting the answer to this question of how do left-wing people relate to the Democratic Party, I want to emphasize that I just think that is one of the key questions that has animated and held back social struggles before in the past throughout American history. The thing is, there are a lot of right-wing parties out there in the world, you know, like the Labour Party of Australia, who socialists also think we should not tie ourselves to. And yet, the Democrats are a level even worse than that, because they're not even a reformist party that purports to represent the working class in however distorted a form. They are openly the party of large sections of the capitalist class of America. you know, it's the Liberal Party of Australia or the Tories in UK. These are examples of a similar kind of party, a party that was set up by the capitalist class to promote their class interests. They not only want to run capitalism, they're led by, funded by, and made up of actual capitalists and their allies. So I think because of that, the position of Marxists is that it's a completely unsupportable party both to work inside of or even to vote for. And I think that doesn't mean that for socialists our approach is, you know, that we just kind of sit back and ignore things until the revolution. Socialists absolutely are for initiating campaigns over the demands that figures like Sanders, AOC and Mamdani have raised. Things like fights for rent controls, higher wages, taxes on the rich. However, I think it's really important that we have an orientation of trying to build our own organisations that seek to win people to an explicitly socialist strategy. And I think key to that strategy is about trying to harness the power of the struggle of ordinary people in activist campaigns, protests on the streets, and in the potential power of the working class, who not only make up the majority of society, but actually have strategic positions that give them power. You know, unions can fight for things, they can win things. Even recently in American history, there was a 7-week strike at Boeing in Seattle last year, people might have seen, in which metal workers there won a 38% pay rise over 4 years. And I just think, like, looking to harnessing that power, looking to trying to get those levers turning, that is the task for socialists in America today. And as I said earlier, I think, you know, there are signs partly in the popularity of these figures for how much a receptive audience in America exists for an approach that actually ties, that, you know, takes up socialist politics and one that could tie it to working class self-activity towards combativity. So far, though, the examples of struggles that have done this are still the exception. For the most part, you know, the working class, left-wing people, all of it, remain trapped inside the Democratic Party and their struggles remain fragmented. So if people in America, if ordinary people, working class people, the left are actually going to defeat Trump and to fight the oligarchy, they have to be able to move on beyond this to actually leverage their own independent power. They have to be able to mobilise and pursue their own demands independent of the Democratic Party machine. And to achieve that, I think they need socialist organisation with socialist politics. That is really, I think, the key task for socialists in America and for socialists everywhere.